Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and I'd love to tell you about my podcast, Dare to Lead. Innovation, creativity, building a better, more just world, all of these things require absolutely courageous leadership, especially given the complexity and chaos of the world right now. The Dare to Lead podcast is a collection of conversations with change catalysts, culture shifters, some troublemakers, folks who are really daring to create and change the world. I hope you join us.
I'd like to ask him, so Mr. President, when exactly was America great? And from your perspective, was it back in the 19th century when we had slavery? I guess clearly not. Was it great when women didn't have the right to vote? I assume not. Was it when we had a system essentially of American apartheid? I assume not.
Hello, welcome to the Zircon Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. You all know that one of my obsessions of late has been whether America still is a democracy, whether it ever has been, whether it is one, whether it should be one, but in particular, how some of the distortions in the system, ranging from the Electoral College to the way geography becomes representation, to gerrymandering, to the filibuster, how they're ending up stacking the political deck, how they're making outcomes less legitimate, and how increasingly there is a divide between a Democratic Party that wants a more small-d democratic America and a Republican Party that sees more democracy as a threat to its interests. And that, to me, is a pretty dangerous space. Someone whose work I've been interested in this space is Eric Holder. Eric Holder, of course, was the Attorney General under President Barack Obama, the first African-American Attorney General. Since leaving the White House, he has founded and chairs the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. And that's become not just the focus of his political work, but also the focus of much of President Obama's post-presidential political work. He actually recently merged Organizing for America into this project. And I think the reason for it is a growing sense that if you don't get some of the fundamental questions of elections right and representation right, then all the other policy you care about, climate change, healthcare, economy, whatever it is, it doesn't work out. It's not going to be there. So I wanted to have Holder on the show to talk about that work, to talk about what motivates it, what its chances are, what the strategies he's trying to employ are, what he thinks of some of the counter arguments to it. And also to think a little bit more broadly about other parts of his legacy and his role, some of the speeches he gave on race in the Obama era, some of the work he did or did not do in terms of prosecuting financial crimes during the financial crisis, or prosecuting bankers, I should say, during the financial crisis. I think it's a pretty interesting conversation. I appreciate him taking the time to do it. So as you can email me at EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Here is Eric Holder. Eric Holder, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
You made a comment recently about what you're trying to do that struck me as really telling. You called your work a partisan effort at good government. Can you talk a bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think the reality is that the two parties stand on different sides of this electoral fairness issue. And for us to get as a nation back to the place where I think we need to be, which is to have just a fair electoral system, one that is, you know, gives the people the opportunity to truly express their views. The Democratic Party has to take on the Republican Party and fight for that fairness. But I always say, as I talk to people, what we're trying to do with the National Democratic Redistricting Committee is not to come up with a system that gerrymanders for Democrats. I simply want to get to a place where we have fair contests, because I'm really confident that if we have fair contests, fair elections, Democrats and progressives will do just fine. We have the right program. We are connected to the people on the issues. Demography is tending our way. And I think the only way that Republicans continue to maintain the political power that they have achieved is through by cheating, in essence.
What's lurking behind that word fair? What are the principles that make an electoral system fair?
Well, I think you have to look first at kind of results. You would expect to have legislatures that kind of generally reflect the way in which the people have voted. We have seen since the gerrymandering that Republicans did in 2011, in state after state, the federal level as well. where you have results that are inconsistent with what the people voted for, where you have Democrats winning substantially, getting substantially greater numbers of votes, but getting far fewer seats in state legislatures and in Congress than Republicans do. So that's a first place, I think, that you have to look. And in some ways, it's the greatest test. I think, you know, the Supreme Court will be looking at what happened in Wisconsin as a result of the gerrymandering. They'll be looking at Wisconsin. They'll be looking at North Carolina. And in those two states, you see places where, you know, Democrats got over 50%, you know, on one federal level. When it comes to the state level, I guess in Wisconsin, close to 60%, and ended up with, you know, less than 50% of the seats in the legislature. And that disconnect is fundamentally unfair, and it's inconsistent with who we say we are, you know, as a people.
But if fairness is a emanation of democracy itself, then is gerrymandering the main target? I mean, you guys aren't attacking equal representation in the Senate, but the differences between, say, California and Wyoming representation are more unfair from that level than, you know, gerrymanderings in most of the states. So is there something unique about gerrymandering that has made it the focus of your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is an immediate problem in the sense that we saw what the impact was of the 2011, I would say, illegitimate redistricting process. And we have another one coming up in 2021. And we want to try to make sure that that process is, in fact, fair. We want to make sure that the census upon which that redistricting is done is fair in 2020. But the questions you're talking about now are really more fundamental ones. But I think questions that we as a nation really need to ask ourselves. You know, we're looking at an electoral system when it comes to the presidency, for instance, that might have been, you know, might have had some, made some sense, although I'd argue that it didn't make an awful lot of sense. It was a product of compromise when the Constitution, you know, was put in place back in the 18th century. And I think we have to ask ourselves in the 21st century, is the Electoral College, for instance, something that needs to continue? And then I think there is a really fundamental question, I think, as we look at the ways in which our population is moving. I've read things that say that, you know, we potentially will have 70% of the people represented by 30% of the Senate at some point, you know, later in this century. That's a question, I think, that, you know, we ought to be asking ourselves. But in terms of what I need to focus on immediately, I'm looking at a fair census and also a fair redistricting process. But that doesn't mean that I don't also think about, and I think the nation needs to think about, you know, the Electoral College, how the Senate is actually constructed. I think also the notion of, you know, term limits when it comes to you know, federal judges, and in particular, the Supreme Court. These are all kinds of things that made sense, you know, as a product of compromise back in the, you know, the 18th century. But in the 21st, we should certainly question whether or not those systems are consistent with the needs of the American people.
I want to put a pin in the census question and come back to it. Back to this question of democracy, one of my concerns is that when you look at the Electoral College, when you look at the Senate, and the distribution of state partisanship, and when you look at gerrymandering and geography in the House, you have the anti-small-D Democratic elements of the system all give a partisan boost to the Republican Party. And the effect of that seems to me to be that democracy is becoming a position of the Democratic Party, and gerrymandering, voter ID laws, different kinds of voter obstacles, and just a less democratic system is becoming the position of the Republican Party. And that looks like a very dangerous place for a system to be in when there begins to be a divergence on the fundamental rules under which the system should operate. Mm-hmm. Are we going there?
Yeah, I think that is a legitimate concern. It is one thing for the parties to disagree about policy and have questions about how our, you know, what economic policies we should follow, what how should we be conducting our foreign policy. I mean, those are legitimate concerns. But when we are in a process where you have the two parties fighting about the system itself, that I think gives me that gives me great concern. When you have Democrats, and I think that I'm being pretty objective when I say this. When you say that you have Democrats essentially fighting for fairness, and Republicans fighting to protect their illegitimately obtained gains through a variety of techniques, whether it's gerrymandering, these voter suppression laws, what they've tried to do, what they're trying to do in connection with the census and in the inclusion of that citizenship question. You know, there's a whole variety of things that Republicans are doing that I think are anti-democratic and inconsistent with who we say we are as a people, what our values are, and ultimately corrosive. And will have a really negative impact on the nation. And, you know, Mitch McConnell and all the folks who are doing all these things can think about short-term political gain, but without any feeling for or any concern for what this means over the long term and the harm that is done done to the nation.
But isn't it working out for them? I mean, Mitch McConnell says that the single most important decision he's ever made was blocking Merrick Garland. And I think that you can say that that worked out great. It arguably helped elect, maybe arguably elected Donald Trump. And it gave Republicans not just continued control of the Supreme Court, but it also allowed them to push back gerrymandering cases. It allowed them to keep Citizens United around. It allowed them to keep building the rules such that Republicans can keep power. So it looks to me that if you believe what Mitch McConnell believes, and if you're on Mitch McConnell's side, you know, he goes down as a hero.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, yeah, you can say that in 2019, but history is long. And history is written not at the moment, but over time. And the impact of what happens in 2019 doesn't necessarily mean that because it's good for the Republican Party now, it will be judged good by historians as something that they should be proud of, or that it will have a positive impact for the Republican Party as the years pass. People's, you know, you galvanize the opposition by taking unprincipled steps like keeping Merrick Garland from a vote. That galvanizes the opposition. People have memories. The electorate has a collective memory. And that which you are successful in doing today can have negative political consequences in the future. And certainly, it's not something that, you know, you can be on the wrong side of history and have, you know, short-term political gain. And I suspect that that's how history is going to view that which McConnell did, especially with regard to, you know, to Merrick Garland and with regard to all the other things that the party itself is doing on a more widespread basis when it comes to, you know, these voter suppression laws. You know, all the other things that they are doing to try to maintain power almost at any cost.
You know, I have a colleague who makes a point that we have this desire for divine punishment, but because it's not really a language we have anymore, we turn to this idea that history will judge you, right? That there will be this punishment after you're gone, and it will be the way you're written about or not written about in history books. And I always think about that when I hear this. I always wonder if Mitch McConnell cares how he's thought about in history, or, you know, he'll get a good, you know, whenever he does end this role, he'll get a good lobbying job. He'll be here to contemporary Republicans. Maybe it'll turn out fine for him. But I want to go back to something on gerrymandering, which is your view and your organization's view is that gerrymandering should not be a partisan activity. It should be given to independent commissions as it is in states like California. You came out against a plan from New Jersey Democrats to entrench a more aggressive pro-democratic gerrymandering, pro-large-D democratic gerrymandering in New Jersey. Something, a point somebody made to me is that it's easy to imagine a world where groups like yours are very persuasive in bluish states. And so Democrats end up with relatively neutral maps because in a lot of those states, they currently gerrymander in their own direction. But it's not very persuasive in red states, so Republicans keep gerrymandering aggressively. And so what you end up having is unilateral disarmament in the gerrymandering wars by Democrats. And this partisan effort for good governance means a larger kind of delta for Republicans in drawing maps. Do you worry about that?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, it's not as if I'm only looking at, you know, Democratic states and saying, look, New Jersey and you other Democratic states, you can't, you shouldn't gerrymander. And that's the only thing I'm doing. No, what I'm doing with the NDRC is really looking at the nation as a whole. And we are working in red states to make those systems more fair. You know, we're fighting for, those ballot initiatives, an advocacy campaign. We're bringing lawsuits in those states. We're trying to elect Democrats in those states so that we redress the imbalances that were inappropriately put in place by the Republicans. So, I certainly want to get to a point where we are simply doing things in a fair way, but that doesn't mean that I'm naive. And I understand that, there's a fight that we need to have in red states in dealing with entrenched, illegitimately obtained power. And we're trying to use all the mechanisms that we have available to us to overcome that entrenched power and make fair those systems. Because I'm really confident that if we do that, if we are successful in red states and let the people decide that, Democrats, progressives, as I said, will do just fine. That doesn't mean that we're going to, Democrats, progressives are going to suddenly turn Wyoming blue or Idaho blue. That I suspect not going to happen. But states like, North Carolina, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, these are places that have Republican legislatures to a degree that they should not have. And once you do that, then we can start talking about, fairness in a way that is more universal.
But I think the concern here is not that you're not going to be trying in those red states, to be fair to the critics here. It's that you're going to convince the blue states, right? California's already there. You're going to convince, say, New York. But that in Texas, you're going to get rebuffed. You're going to fail. It's not that you're not going to try. It's that you're going to fail. Because for the exact reason we were just talking about, you just said that, it is clear that if Republicans are playing on more fair ground in a lot of these states, they know they're going to lose quite a lot of power. And they don't want to lose that power. And those states are red, and they're red for a reason. And in many of those states, you have majorities, big majorities of Republicans. And so that the end outcome will be a world where you have a pretty solid blue approach to redistricting, which is independent. Maybe the purple states are a little bit mixed and the red states are putting a heavy thumb on the scales, and that will be a place where, Democrats end up with a significant disadvantage.
Yeah. See, but I don't buy into the notion that change is not possible in red states. And so the question is, what's the mechanism in every state that you can use that will change that state? And it'll be different approaches in different states. North Carolina, for instance, I think is so gerrymandered that an electoral approach will probably not work there. And that's why we brought a lawsuit in the state court system. I want to point out, we brought a lawsuit in the state court system, as we did in Pennsylvania, where, again, under the state constitution, the courts there ruled that what the Republicans had done violated the Pennsylvania state constitution. Same theory that we're using in North Carolina. If we are successful in that lawsuit, and I think we will be, it will ultimately be decided by the North Carolina Supreme Court. If we're successful there, well, that really unlocks North Carolina in a really significant way. And that red state can then become what I think it is, kind of a, kind of a purple state. And I would argue that probably leans a little blue. And so, fighting for litigation in North Carolina will work. In other states, we take, even in these gerrymandered districts, we fight for electoral success. We won governor's races last in 2018. We flipped legislative chambers. We broke supermajorities in red states. So, we passed ballot reform measures in Utah, in Missouri. These are red states. That's another thing I think people have to understand. If I ask the Republican legislature in Texas to do the right thing, they're not going to do the right thing. On the other hand, if you appeal to the people in Texas and make sure that they understand the impact of this partisan gerrymandering and how it affects their lives on a day-to-day basis, ultimately the power of the people can overcome the resistance, the inappropriate resistance by the those who hold power, the Republican Party.
Let me ask you about the legal side of this. What tends to make a gerrymander unconstitutional versus one that is constitutional?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, there are a number of factors. You look at whether or not a particular district has communities of interest, whether there's some geographic sense to it, you know, contiguity makes sense. You look at these districts and, you know, it's, I guess I forget who the justice was, you know, can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. Well, you can look at these gerrymandered districts, and you can tell when they are gerrymandered. It had one in Pennsylvania that was called, I guess, Goofy Kicking Donald Duck, and it was, you know, drawn in all kind of, in a very strange-looking district. Things that tend to look more like, you know, recognizable geometric shapes, where you're not splitting communities either along racial lines, geographic lines, you know, demographic lines. There's a whole variety of things, I think, that go into coming up with what looks like an appropriately drawn district.
Right now, with Kennedy gone and Kavanaugh seated on the Supreme Court, is there a chance of a Supreme Court solution, a national Supreme Court solution on gerrymandering?
Well, there certainly should be. The court has had before it, you know, the Wisconsin and Maryland case, I guess North Carolina case is bouncing back up there now. If you look at North Carolina and if you look at Wisconsin, and you can't say that you know, under the theories that were advanced, you know, First Amendment, you know, the scientific test that was used, if you can't say that there's something wrong there, something unconstitutional there, I just don't quite understand how the court can pass and simply say that that's consistent with the founders' view of the republic. Now, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Justice Kennedy seemed to be one who was, you know, essentially said, you can go too far, but I don't think I've ever seen a test that could be used by judges.
It's like, he's gone. It's like porn. You know it when you've seen it. But I've never seen it. I'd never look at anything like that.
Me either. I'm just talking theoretically here, you know. Now we have Justice Kavanaugh, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, what he does. So hopefully the court will do the right thing there. But you know, we're not going to be reliant on and waiting for a United States Supreme Court decision. That's why we are going through the states and the state constitutions. And where we have that capacity, where we have that ability, we're going to be bringing those lawsuits, as we did in Pennsylvania and as we recently filed in North Carolina.
Support for the Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. All too often, people like the owl monkey and the Australian sea lion only see the world in black or white. Now, regular listeners of this podcast, who are mostly humans, understand that the world is more complicated than that. There's also plenty of gray areas. The world of business is a great example. See what I did there? An S&P 500 company and a small business owner have to see things differently, which is why NetSuite wants to provide products and services tailor-made for any business. NetSuite is a top-rated cloud financial system that brings accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into a single platform. NetSuite lives in the cloud, which can reduce IT costs and can improve efficiency and cut back on mistakes by bringing all your major business processes into one platform. NetSuite says that more than 37,000 companies have already made the move. Maybe it's time you did the same. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. You can head to netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area.
Tell me a bit about the concerns over the 2020 census, because this is an issue that I think a lot of people are not that up on.
Yeah, I mean, people really need to focus on the census to make sure that we have an accurate count. I mean, yeah, you know, when it comes to 2021, the lines will be drawn on the basis of the census. What people also need to understand is about $675 billion in federal aid for infrastructure, for education, is also doled out on the basis of the census that is done in 2020. And so we want to have a fair count. We want to have an accurate count. And the Trump administration's desire to include this citizenship question is really an attempt to suppress the vote in a particular community, in the Hispanic community.
Talk to me like I've never heard of this before. Like, what do you mean by a citizenship question?
Yeah. What they want to do is include on the long form of the census for the first time since 1950, a question that asks people who are replying to the census, are you a citizen of the United States? The Constitution says that you're supposed to count all the people in the United States. It doesn't say you're supposed to count all the citizens in the United States. And you're supposed to reapportion on the basis of the number of people that are in particular states, that are in particular districts. They want to include this citizenship question, I think, first, as I said, to try to suppress the Hispanic response out of people being expressing people in the Hispanic community being concerned that although they might be citizens, that if they raise their hands to be counted, it potentially puts at risk people who are undocumented and who they associate with. And so that is, I think, one of their theories. And by suppressing the Hispanic vote, which they, I think, rightly see as more Democratic than Republican, they will have an ability to, when it comes to redistricting and the distribution of federal money, put more money, find greater numbers of seats for Republican areas as opposed to Democratic ones.
I think that a lot of people listening to this would just say, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, why not have a citizenship question on the census? Why shouldn't we be counting people who are here legally rather than people who are here illegally? So make the case to me. You know, what would you say to somebody who says this is not a place where there should be a fight?
Well, you know, this is simply not the way we've done it. It's also not the way in which the founders said the census should be conducted. You know, the Republicans always talk about originalism and what did the founders intend? You know, they said count the people who are in the United States. They didn't say count the citizens who are in the United States. The reality is that all the people who are in this country have an impact on the quality of our lives, the resources that that they take. We need to know who is in the United States, get a sense of, you know, what's the number of the people who are in this country, be they citizens, permanent residents, those who are here undocumented. We just need to know that. And I don't see why people, you know, fear that. I see the political gain that can be made by trying to restrict the count that I think is unconstitutional to simply citizens. But to do it in a way that's, again, consistent with what the founders' vision was, and just from my perspective, in just a logical way, you should want to know how many people are here in the United States of America.
It feels to me like this census fight and what's behind it is our entire politics right now in microcosm. And I wonder how you feel about this as somebody who served as the first African-American attorney general and served under the first African-American president. It feels to me like the fundamental collision in America right now is between a political coalition that looks to a more diverse country in the future with hope and sees that as a change they can believe in, and a coalition that looks towards that with fear and wants to turn the clock back on it and literally build a wall against it to change the census so that in the count we make of the country, it looks more like the country that was than the country that is or is becoming. It feels to me that it's a question of values, as a question of like, what are we really talking about in this country? Like, this is right there. Like, do we want to admit what the country is becoming, or do we want to both try to make it something different and try to ignore what it is?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I think that's a really fundamental difference between these parties. The Republican Party is looking back. You know, you hear it in what Trump says, make America great again. And I always ask myself, I'd like to ask him, so, Mr. President, when exactly was America great? And from your perspective, was it back in the 19th century when we had slavery? I guess clearly not. Was it great when women didn't have the right to vote? I assume not. Was it when we had a system essentially of American apartheid? I assume not. But the Republican Party is looking back towards an America that they think existed and they think was, you know, a good America. And my argument would be there that, yeah, you know, we look at Leave It to Beaver and that was great, and June Cleaver with her pearls and cleaning the house and all of that stuff. That's an America that that existed in the minds of certain people. But that was also a time when women were treated in unfair, inappropriate ways, when people of color did not have all the rights to which they were entitled as American citizens. That's the America that Donald Trump and the Republican Party look to. The Democratic Party, by contrast, is willing to look forward, look to the future, and that's an interesting thing. You know, to embrace the uncertainty of the future, that is something that is pretty bold, because, as I just said, you know, the future is always uncertain. But America is always at its best when we have embraced the challenges, the uncertainties of the future, and then tried to mold that future in an American way. It's what produced the American century, that made the 20th century an American century. And that attitude can make the 21st century an American century as well.
This is a good bridge to something that I've long wanted to talk to you about. So it's 1 month after Obama's elected president, where it's supposed to be our grand post-racial future. You know, people are excited. And you give this speech saying that though this nation has proudly thought of itself as an ethnic melting pot, in things racial, we have always been and continue to be in too many ways essentially a nation of cowards. What led you to say that at that time? Like, what was the thinking that led to you to write the speech in that way at that moment?
Yeah, you know, it was a Black History Month speech, and so I was focused on, you know, that theme, Black history. And I think that one of the things you got to do, you got to read that speech in its entirety. And I looked at it about 3-4 weeks ago, and it's actually held up.
I've got lots of quotes from it here, don't worry.
Yeah. Now, I think it's actually held up pretty well. And what I wanted to do was to say something a little controversial, to stir some conversation. I didn't anticipate it was going to cause that much, you know, conversation, that much controversy. But I think that what I said was accurate. You know, we always talk about how this nation is a melting pot, and yet we become expert at avoiding really kind of the difficult racial conversations. And I say in the speech, you know, these conversations are certainly going to be painful, certainly at the beginning and maybe painful throughout, but they are necessary conversations if we want to make real racial progress. And so that was the point that I was making. Not that Americans are, you know, generally cowards or anything like that. I mean, that's the way the right has tried to characterize it. It was really about our fear. And from both sides, whether you're a person of color or you know, a person who is white, that we just don't talk to one another enough about racial things.
Yeah, see, you say in the speech, we know by American instinct and by learned behavior that certain subjects are off limits and that to explore them risks at best embarrassment and at worst the questioning of one's character. And I was reading this speech, and one of the things I thought when I read it is that a lot of folks, I don't even want to say on the right here, a lot of white folks would say, yeah, like this is actually why I'm afraid to talk about it, because if I make a mistake, I'm going to be called out for a microaggression or for being racially insensitive or for being racist or for not being politically correct. So is it the left's fault that people are so afraid here?
No, I wouldn't say it's the left's fault, but I think that what you've just said is a legitimate concern that I have heard expressed and that I understand. And that's what I was trying to say in that speech, that people need to be given the space to ask questions, to make observations, to not be labeled as insensitive, as racist. People can come from a genuinely good place and want to, understand and express things that might not be politically correct, but that are genuinely felt and, is a mechanism for people to get to, the America that we want to have. And people, I was trying to say, need to have that space. Don't need to have their motivations questioned. They don't need to be labeled as anything. That, we can't have... the racial police coming in and saying, you can't say that. Or if you say that, you are this kind of person. I was really doing what I could in that speech to try to foster the dialogue that I don't think we as a nation have often enough.
I was trying to think, reading the speech, if I was sure that having those conversations would really lead to a more tolerant or more open or more loving country. A part of me read that and thought, is Trump in some ways an example of what people talking more honestly about race, with less fear of offending each other, with less fear of what is politically correct, sound like? Is, we were talking a couple minutes ago about there being a pretty large coalition in this country that just thinks this is getting worse. The way this is going is getting worse. The way the country is, as it is becoming more diverse, is getting worse. The way I feel in it is worse. And I think Trump speaks very powerfully for them. And I think he speaks for them in a way that is a lot less polite and a lot less careful and a lot more willing to have, in some ways, a hard conversation than those who came before them. But it's not felt to me like a better conversation. Just having a more honest collision between these visions of America and between the ways that demographic change makes people feel has not felt to me like it has led to a better place in this country. So I'm curious how you reflect on the Trump experience in the context of this argument.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, again, if I'm going to give people the space to say that which they truly feel, the people who are saying these things that might seem, at least in first blush, offensive or, of concern, these folks have to be willing to accept facts that I might, share with them. And that, I think, is the Trump problem. He bases policy and observation on stereotypes, prejudices, as opposed to facts. He's going to speak, about the need for emergencies and borders, out of control with terrorists and everything. And, there's no factual basis to many of the things that he says. And, he's squandered because he lies so much, that which an American president, I think, really has to have. People have to believe, the president. When John Kennedy in 1962 says that there are missiles, Russian missiles in Cuba, and before we see the pictures and all that stuff, as we're going to impose a naval, quarantine, you've got to believe the president. And, if we get to a crisis situation with this president, are the American people going to believe Donald Trump? His diehard supporters, which, is ever shrinking, I guess, I'm not even sure they believe it. They're willing to take, I think, his falsehoods because they believe in some of the policy positions that he espouses. I don't think they necessarily believe him. And so I think, if we're going to have people express these concerns, these views, they've got to be willing to accept facts that might come back at them to shake some of those beliefs, those stereotypes that they adhere to.
But that feels to me a little bit like looking for the world as we think it ought to be, as opposed to as it is. Agreeing for a minute that we should have a high bar for our presidents, and that Donald Trump, I think probably in both of our views, does not meet it. In terms of the way just people experience the world, we're just not that fact-based. you know, most of us. And a lot of those of us who are or think we are kind of not too, right? We're motivated in our reasoning and we're biased towards our group. And, you know, we listen to some groups and not others. And, you know, and even, you know, there's all this evidence that the smarter you are, the easier it is to deceive yourself by putting together, you know, a lot of facts that are not the full picture. You know, people like climate change deniers have a lot of facts about climate change. They're just wrong, or they're wrong in the way they put them together. And so I guess the question I have for you in this, because there's a part of it that is very appealing to me, is, you know, how would these conversations happen? You know, something in that speech was that it was a very general speech. You know, how would you imagine these conversations happening? Because what you point out, that as this country changes, that either we're going to find a way to sort of talk through it and live through it and you know, come closer together through it, or it's going to tear us apart, feels right to me. But when I look around, I feel like we're seeing the tearing apart. And I feel like part of that's because nobody knows, nobody has a good model for what these better conversations should look like, or what the structure under which they would happen is.
Yeah. You know, I think these conversations happen in a whole variety of ways. They happen, you know, at the workplace. They happen in social situations. They happen, you know, where people gather. As I said in the speech, you know, we have to create, in some ways, artificial mechanisms to foster these conversations. And, you know, Black History Month, I think I said in the speech, is, you know, one of these artificial mechanisms that we can use to talk about the experience of Black people in this country, the ongoing problems of being a person of color in this country. And these are not things that are necessarily going to just flow naturally, at least certainly at the beginning. But I think these are the kinds of conversations that I think we can construct, that we can have. And yeah, I think people, you know, maybe are not fact-based, but I think it's more ignorance than anything that I think we have to be concerned about. You know, people, folks in the North, you know, white people in the North, didn't care maybe an awful lot, or to care to the degree that they should have, about what Black folks were dealing with in the South in the, you know, 1940s, 1950s, you know, the early part of the 20th century. And yet, when they saw pictures of you know, demonstrators and how they were treated, when they saw, you know, dogs let on people, fire hoses put on people, when they saw my late sister-in-law, you know, being denied the opportunity to enroll at the University of Alabama, that kind of information, you know, that factually based information, moved people. It moved this nation. And I always, you know, I'm optimistic that, you know, the sharing of information can move this country in positive ways. And, you know, if we retreat into those racial cocoons that I talked about in the speech, it's easy to demonize, it's easy to stereotype people. You know, you can talk about immigrants and how bad they are. But if you happen to know people who are recent immigrants, and you see that they are hardworking, that they want the same kinds of things that that you do, that they want their kids to have a good education, they want to be in neighborhoods that are, you know, are crime-free, that they work hard, it's hard to demonize a person like that. And that's why this interaction, I think, is so vitally important.
I've heard people say that this country needs something akin to a Truth and Reconciliation Commission for its own racial past, that it wasn't enough to pass a couple of laws, that we actually need to have a kind of conversation and an airing of what happened and what is happening and how it has been experienced in some kind of protected national space. Do you think there's something to that?
Yeah. I think, I'm not sure exactly how you would construct it, but I think something like that would be a positive, to have, you know, a frank conversation, a frank airing of historical wrongs, present day concerns, in a protected space, as you put it, and somehow draw national attention to that process. That would be a good thing, and you know, it would be something that in this era would be seen as partisan and people trying to gin up, you know, political bases and all of this stuff. But it is, you know, taking away the partisanship and thinking just about, you know, the health of the nation. I think that something like that would have a positive impact.
Well, I don't even know if it'd be seen as partisan. The thing that I think would be seen as above all is divisive. I think one of the deep divides on race in this country is between people who think that there's nothing to talk about, that we should be over this, and the problem is some people just like won't let us move on. You know, we passed the Civil Rights Act, you know, we passed the Voting Rights Act, so much so that, in fact, the Supreme Court decided part of it didn't matter anymore, that it's time to move on, that it's time to stop, you know, having this conversation. And then people say, who, you know, make the argument that, no, like, there's so much we don't know and there's so much that is not understood by people who haven't experienced it. And so much of conversations about political correctness and identity politics and playing the race card and affirmative action actually feel to me like they come down to this underlying question of, do you believe that there is some conversation we need to have here or not? Or do you believe the problem is there are these people in this country who keep making us have this conversation instead of just talking about class or just talking about, you know, personal responsibility or culture or whatever it might be? And that feels like the thing we can't get. I mean, in a relationship, right? If you have a marriage and one person feels like we've really got to talk about this trauma that happened a couple years back because like it affects everything every day for me. And the other person feels it was years back. Like my cheating was years back. My abuse was years back. Like it is time for you to get over it. Like that relationship is not going to work out, right? Like you need agreement on talking about the things that are hard. And we really fundamentally don't have that.
Yeah. You know, people say, you know, we keep having this conversation or we keep talking about these issues. And what we do is we have these superficial conversations about these issues. We don't really get into the guts of, you know, what happened to people of color in our past, what the present day effects of that treatment are, I mean, and how it still exists, what the impact of that treatment still exists here in the 21st century. We don't talk about that in an in-depth way. We just kind of, you know, poke at it every now and again, and we think, all right, well, we've talked about that enough. Let's go to something else. I mean, as I said in that speech, these are conversations that are painful. They are painful. You know, if you're using your analogy, all right, you're in a relationship and somebody's had an affair, you have to have that painful conversation. Why did this happen? What does that affair mean? Is it a reflection of some kind of, you know, deep and abiding problem in this relationship? Was it simply a mistake? Those are the kinds of conversations that I think you have in relationships about a whole variety of things. I'm a married person, and I've had a whole variety of conversations with my wife about, you know, kids and whatever. And as a nation, it's a difficult thing. Again, these are not easy conversations to have. They're not easy conversations to construct. But I still think, as I did back in February of, I guess, 2009, that these are necessary conversations.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds 4 times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
So I want to ask you about something else in that Obama administration period. We have this Facebook group for The Weeds, which is our policy podcast. And I often go to it and ask for, you know, are there things people would like to hear me ask of guests here? And the overwhelming top question I got for you was, why didn't the Department of Justice send more bankers to jail during the financial crisis?
Well, because on the basis of Justice Department policy, the facts that we were able to uncover, the law as it exists, we were simply unable to make those cases. Now, I think we start with this basic understanding that we got record amounts of money from these financial institutions who we found did inappropriate things with regard to mortgage-backed securities. Record amounts of money, billions of dollars that we didn't put in the federal treasury, but we did move back to people who had been unfairly treated. And so, you know, I've gotten letters from people said, thanks for, you know, helping me get it, you know, get money back and all that. So we start with that as kind of a foundation. And I think people need to ask themselves, do you actually think that if we could have made these cases with the aggressive U.S. attorneys that I served with, that we would not have brought them? You know, we have a Justice Department policy that says you can't bring a case unless you have a better than 50% chance of winning that case. And as you looked at the way, the fact patterns that we had, the diffuse way in which decision making was made in the banks, and look at the state of the law as it existed, we simply were unable to bring those cases. When I left, I gave a speech at NYU, and I said, we need to change that law. We need to change the standard that we have to meet in order to bring these kinds of cases. I mean, if we could have brought those cases, we certainly would have. We simply, as a result of the facts and the law as it existed and I guess continues to exist, just had a hard time in bringing those cases.
So you obviously have so much more information about these cases and the underlying laws here than I do. And so I don't question any of that, or if I tried to, I'd fail. But what I want to ask you about that is that, does that then suggest if the financial system could crash the global economy, if there could be the patterns of fraud that we've identified, and the Justice Department can look at these cases and say, we're probably not going to win any of them, does that suggest that our laws around finance are simply wrong? Or is the fact that this question keeps coming up mean that, you know, there is a desire for vengeance in the population, that's just the problem, that the problem is people want a punishment for something that was, you know, business decisions or economic outcomes? Are we an unjust society, or are we an overly vengeful polity?
No, I think people had, you know, expressed legitimate outrage at that period, where you had, you know, the bailouts, where you had the average person, you know, with a mortgage, you know, maybe losing their house. I mean, no, that I don't think was vengeful. I think there was, you know, legitimate concern about the way in which that whole thing played out. But I think it's not only a question of changing, you know, our criminal laws and the standards, you know, as I said in that speech. I also think we have to look back at, you know, some of the policies that we have put in place when it comes in. You're more the economist, you know, than I am. But look at the changes that we have made over the years when it comes to, you know, economic regulation. This whole notion of deregulation and has not necessarily been all good. And you know, getting back to some of the things that we put in place as a result of, you know, our reaction to the Depression and a lot of these New Deal things that we put in place were actually good. And the unwinding of those statutes, those regulations, has not necessarily been something that has been good for the country.
But agreeing with that and agreeing that there are a lot of policy changes we should make, given what the policy was, in your view, should what bankers did have been illegal? Should what bankers did have been prosecutable with jail time?
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that you could hold individuals as opposed to institutions, to the extent you could show that individuals made determinations to engage in fraudulent conduct with regard to the sale of these mortgage-backed securities. If you could make those kinds of cases, yes, people should have been held criminally liable. And we made attempts to do exactly that. I assigned cases to specific U.S. attorneys, specific banks were given to a, you know, particular, let's say, you know, the First National Bank of whatever was given to a U.S. attorney in a particular place. I picked my best U.S. attorneys and said, all right, you know, do all that you can with regard to holding the bank as an entity responsible, but then look for individuals within that bank who need to be held accountable. And so that's the mechanism that we put together. And then I guess on a weekly basis, I had a U.S. attorney come in and report to me on the First National Bank of whatever. So where do we stand with regard to holding the bank responsible, and how does it look with regard to holding individuals accountable? And so that's the process that we went through. Those are the attempts that that we made.
So I hear you when you say the cases weren't there. I guess my question is, were the laws wrong and they should have been there? Were the laws wrong such that the question of whether people were engaged in fraud or whether they engaged in societally like weaponized irresponsibility, I think is a difficult and an interesting one. And I hear you say that, you know, if people engaged in fraud, it should have been illegal. But it's not clear, I assume, because the cases weren't brought, that they did. And so I guess the thing that a lot of people feel, and the thing that I feel, to be honest about it, is that that level of social irresponsibility, it seems like something should be wrong with it. And is that a question for the legal system or not? Like, is our standard there so high, or are our laws there so permissive that we're missing something fundamental that is necessary to bring the right incentives to that industry?
Yeah. I mean, I think people have to understand there's a difference between things that happened that were wrong and things that were illegal. And there's no question that there were a lot of things that happened during that era that were wrong. My determination as Attorney General was to find things that were illegal. Now, when it comes to dealing with the stuff that was wrong, you know, why didn't we have, you know, really robust congressional hearings and to examine what happened during that era, and try to look at what happened, why it happened, and come up with ways in which we would deal with that so that it wouldn't happen again. Now, there were some things that were done. I think that were, you know, Consumer Financial Protection Board put together, and other things. I think that was, you know, that was appropriate. I'm not sure that we as a nation did enough and pushed back against, you know, the special interests who would see these reform efforts as being inconsistent with, you know, what was in their best interest. Although they might have been in the best interest of the country, those special interests were successful in, I think, circumventing, asking appropriate questions and coming up with putting in place more mechanisms so that we don't have a repeat of what happened in 2007, 2008.
So one of the reasons I ask this is because I think it loops back to the broader conversation we were having at the beginning over redistricting and good government. There's this feeling that partisans, and in this case particularly Republicans, are rigging the political system, and that that's a big problem. But there's also, I think, a belief that the rich are rigging the system, both by writing too many of the laws directly through political contributions and influence and lobbying, and then in having too much voice in their enforcement, in the guidance given to agencies, in the way sort of laws are shaped in context in society. Do you think that's right? Do you think that the rigging of the rich is as big or a similar kind of problem to the rigging of the GOP?
Well, I don't think there's any question that the system is rigged in a whole variety of ways. Politically, as we have talked about, the way in which the Republican Party has tried to rig the system when it comes to gerrymandering and voter suppression. And then those special interests and those people who are, you know, extremely well off have disproportionate amounts of control of our system, disproportionate amounts of power that is tied to economic wealth. And I think we need to realize that. You know, I think in some ways we are in another gilded age, and I think that, you know, I think we're on the verge of seeing a reform, a period of reform that will be consistent with what we saw in response to the end of the gilded age at the beginning of the 20th century. I really do think that we are, you know, people are really starting to focus on, you know, economic disparities. when you start talking about Medicare for all, when you start people start getting concerned about the way you see income inequality, this is starting to seep into the concerns of the general population. And I think that you will see policies that ultimately will reflect those more general concerns. And as I said, I think if you want to get a sense of what this new reform era will look like, I think you look at the early part of the 20th century, and you'll see a similar kind of reform movement.
Is this part of the unfinished business of the Obama administration? I think sometimes about the way in which President Obama's 2008 campaign was very much about special interests and lobbyists and the ways in which the political system itself felt unfair. And then you get into office and there's a recession, and there's always this trade-off between, are you going to use your political capital on policy like the Affordable Care Act or the stimulus bill that can immediately and positively affect people's lives? Are you going to use that capital on rewriting the rules of the system itself, working on money and politics and gerrymandering and lobbying reform and all these different things? And sort of over and over and over again, politicians, I think, run on changing politics, but then get in and realize or feel that the priority has to be changing policy. Do you think, given what you're now focusing on outside, after the Obama administration, that President Obama himself has merged OFA into Organizing for America into your group, is this the unfinished business that Democrats need to prioritize that political reform agenda for a while above the policy reform agenda next time they get power?
I don't think that you necessarily have to choose. I mean, I think we need to change. We need fundamental change. We need fundamental change. We need to ask questions about our politics and the way in which our political system works. And I also think this notion of, political capital, I mean, I get that. But that's, if you focus on that too much, we have the ability to walk and chew gum at the same time, and I understand that we were focused on, the administration was focused on the Affordable Care Act and making sure that that was something that had to be passed. It was a little frustrating to be at the Justice Department when there were things that, that I wanted to push that had to kind of take a back seat. And I remember thinking at the time, we can push and, we do all the things that we need to do with regard to the ACA, but we also need to look at, what's going on with our criminal justice system. The notion that you got, 435 people in the House, 100 people in the Senate who can only do one thing, one thing at a time, or an administration can only do one thing at a time. You look at what Franklin Roosevelt did in those first 100 days and what the New Deal was all about. I mean, that in some ways, I think, is government at its best. You'd say it was just economic stuff, but I mean, that administration, that president, changed this nation in a whole variety of ways, and we still have that capacity. We've lost faith in, it starts, I think, with the inauguration of Ronald Reagan. The problem is not the people, the problem is government. We've lost faith in our governing capacities, and I think that we need to, be a little bolder. We need to think big things, when it comes to climate change, how we can deal with this problem. How about a moonshot? Think of climate as a moonshot and deal with climate at the same time that we're dealing with reforming our political system. We can do all of these things. We have the capacity.
So I know we are out of time here, but I want to ask you before you go the question that I always use to end the podcast, which is, what are three books you've read over the years that have influenced you that you would recommend to the audience?
Well, here, I would share with the audience three books that I've read most recently. One is An Unfinished Life by Robert Dallek. Talks about one of my heroes, John Kennedy, and his life, his impact on the nation, and from the title, the promise that was lost by his untimely death. The Collected Poems of Langston Hughes, my favorite poet, and my wife gave me that book for Christmas, and I've just been kind of going through that. It's it reaffirmed in me the belief that he is, in some ways, I think, America's poet laureate. And then 1944 by Jay Winnick. a really good book that examines the year, 1944, and really looks at what Roosevelt was doing then. It's really kind of interesting to see how the interaction between the press and the president at that time. But more importantly, talks about how knowledge of the Holocaust was more widespread in the United States. You know, people have this, we work under this belief that, you know, American troops, Soviet troops, discovered these camps and were shocked. And, you know, no one knew about them before that. And he makes a very convincing case that certainly the American government and the American people knew about this to a much greater degree than we, I think, have been willing to accept. So those are three books that I've read and am reading, you know, now that I think I would recommend to everybody.
Eric Holder, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thank you to Eric Holder for being here. Thank you to you for being here. Thank you to UC Berkeley for hosting me, to doing these podcasts, to my engineer, Jeffrey Geld, my producer, Jillian Weinberger. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production, and we'll be back in a couple of days.